Welcome to the Token Intelligence Show. AI is changing the way that we work, and Token Intelligence will help you understand the state of the art, cut through all of the noise, and apply wisdom to become an effective leader in the age of AI. So we're going to do that today by talking about accountability in the workplace with AI really changing the way we do so many things and becoming an integral part of how a lot of people are performing their jobs.
Yeah, because this came up because we were talking about how there's a lot of conversation about taste and judgment right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't heard as much about this topic, so I'm excited to dive in.
Yeah. On the state-of-the-art side of things, why is the taste and judgment conversation so important, do you think? Or actually, define that maybe for listeners who haven't been as exposed to that, you know, as sort of us in the Silicon Valley heat of the moment with AI.
Right. Yeah. So I think taste and judgment were the two words that have come bubbled up to be the things humans contribute when working with AI.
Hmm.
So we'll start with taste. So at least so far, we've found that humans can do better with, let's call it like aesthetics and kind of feel, mm-hmm. look and feel than an AI just by itself.
Yep.
And then judgment, I would just think of evaluating outputs with some kind of human standard and then iterating with AI to achieve that output.
Right. Yep. I have an example of this, which is building a website, right? So yes. I think every single company has gone through the process of redoing their website. And there used to be a technological barrier to this.
Right.
And so you would hire an agency or you would have engineers do this in-house, and you have all these competing needs of people who need to publish content. So you need some sort of content management system. You know, you have designers who want to, you know, make the site look a certain way. You have marketers who want it to perform and convert a certain way. But the technological barrier was really significant, right? And so what ended up happening was you converge on frameworks. So WordPress is a great example, the most popular, you know, website platform in the world. I think it runs a third of the internet. Last time I looked at the statistics, which has been some time. And then within the WordPress ecosystem, you have templating systems, right? So then you don't have to, you know, do everything by hand. And then you sort of, you know, modify templates, right? And so that's why a lot of corporate websites end up looking similar.
Yeah, roughly the same.
You know, which is interesting, right? So if you live in a world where AI can generate any sort of website you want, it could hook it up to any sort of CMS that you want, you know, so that your content team can publish, it can make it performant, then what used to be sort of this taste of like, woo, that's a very avant-garde website, you know, there was a technical barrier keeping most people from investing a lot of their time there.
Right.
If that barrier's gone, then the taste of your design, aesthetic, user experience becomes the new competitive advantage,
right?
Is sort of how I've heard that discussed. On the judgment side, I think it's related, but a lot of times that can be more technical, where AI will do whatever you tell it to do. And so, and it can do almost anything, you know, building software. And so making a good judgment call on how to do something, again, becomes a competitive advantage versus just being able to accomplish it.
Yep. So thinking back to school, did you ever have any classes where you were just in a really unique class where there were just a disproportionate number of like super smart people, like in a particular class?
Yes. Statistics. So I really enjoyed statistics in college, and so I took a lot of statistics courses, which is probably why, you know, I ended up in part of my career, really getting into data. But the more advanced statistics courses, people were very smart because it was, you know, and then maybe some economics too, I think, were the two classes where I just thought, man, there are a ton of super smart people in here.
Yeah. So
how about you?
Yeah. So chemistry is what sticks out for me. Mm. I just had a really smart group that was in my, couple of my chemistry classes, mm-hmm. Which I took with my, was pre-med and liberal arts college. I would have taken probably some anyways, mm-hmm. but chemistry is the one that sticks out to me. But I really think of, for the average company, AI is all of a sudden being in that class and raising the average grades.
Hmm.
So for the average company, I do think the average grade point for work output goes up, at least some. And then that happens kind of across the board. So the average becomes here. Let's just take writing quality. There's not that many people in the world that are very good at writing.
Agreed.
Yeah, agreed.
Hard agree.
But people with AI definitely bumps the average grade. Let's say we're moving from like a C to a B minus or something. Maybe a D to a C. I don't know.
Yeah. That's a whole other episode, yeah, but we can discuss right. that because that is my job.
But yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Even people that are really good at other things.
But generally, yes. Right.
Right.
You know, the average person, if they are decent at prompting, it can really help them, you know, write more clearly.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially for things like
yeah.
email communications or other things like that, right? Board meeting agendas. You know, I mean, there are just so many things that it is genuinely helpful for.
Right. So I think because you're in this new grade with this, like, at least kind of cluster of smart people, like, bringing the average up,
mm-hmm.
And I'm applying this to the taste and judgment piece because now it's like, okay, well, we're all here, mm-hmm. which is a little higher than we used to be and maybe a lot higher for some people.
Yep.
The taste and judgment has been like pushed as a differentiator, but I think, which is still true, but I think, and we're kind of about to get into this, accountability is another factor here that is undersold right now. And I guess you could say, the person or persons accountable for the output, and taste and judgment are two pieces. Judgment for sure, a piece of the output. And so I guess maybe taste is a piece of the input and judgment of the output.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So we're in a world where on average, the floor has been raised. I think the ceiling has been raised significantly, yeah. way more than the floor has been raised, but that's another episode. So the floor is raised for what the average employee can do as far as their work product. You know, let's say the quality, the quantity, right? Just in general, as an aggregate, you know, as an yeah. aggregate measure of their work output. But this introduces really, really hard questions about accountability, because the reason that the floor is raised is that these people are using a tool that is non-deterministic and generative. And so I'm going to define those two things. Because they're important terms to be accurate about, to be precise about. So non-deterministic means that it is not a math equation where you put numbers in and you get numbers out, and because of the rules of mathematics, you reliably get the same output every single time, right?
Yeah.
It is non-deterministic in that new information is being generated, right? And so, and there are factors that influence this. So because you have conversations with Claude, you know, all day about data stuff, and I have conversations with Claude all day about whatever I'm writing about at Vercel or whatever I'm building, even if we ask Claude the same question, we will get different answers. That right. is non-deterministic because right. the context of your previous conversations and the work that you've done, your system prompts everything influence the answer that you're going to get, right? And so two people can ask the same question and get different answers. That's part of the design of the system, actually, right? So that's not necessarily a bug, but it is something to be very cognizant of. And it's generative, meaning that if you and I both, you know, ask Claude to build a strategy, you know, or let's say a plan, you know, a quarterly plan, it will generate new information based on information that you've given it, but yeah. it will literally generate, you know, new text. You're not writing it.
Right.
But that becomes part of your work product as an individual. So there are many things to discuss here specifically with AI, but I want to briefly start with first principles. So let's talk about first principles. Let's talk about specifics with AI, and then let's get practical and talk about, you know, how you and I manage teams and people with accountability. So first principles with accountability, and I'd love the perspective of a manager, like you as a manager, how do you think about accountability done really well?
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to go back to the beginning, and that's Peter Drucker is considered the father of modern management, mm-hmm. and his methodology was management by objectives, MBOs,
mm-hmm.
which turned into and highly influenced OKRs, which is kind of the tech version of that. And then there's more downstream stuff from that, but we can just keep it there, I think.
Yep.
And one of the big innovations, which hardly even feels like an innovation anymore, is essentially multiple levels of management and it not just being like a bunch of people doing task with like one person in charge, telling people what to do
mm-hmm.
like that. Cause that is still kind of the default. Like if you were to work like tomorrow's, like say this weekend you were working, you know, with the kids in the yard, you're like, you know, like you do this and you do that. Like that is kind of a human default of like how to do it.
We open the shed.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of yard tools. Get to work.
Right.
And so what is the result of that going to be?
Right. And the management by objective, the key piece there is the objective piece, is you now have goals, objectives, whatever you want to call it, that a group of people is responsible for. And then maybe there's another group even above that that's responsible for a bigger objective that flows into the smaller objective.
Mm-hmm.
And you have these layers of objectives that are not task level. They're like area of responsibility level. Like an objective is like, you know, grow our sales from X number to Y, not like I want you to like make 10 calls today.
Yep.
So that and then layering and then connecting all that together in an organization is a big component of management for sure.
And so accountability in that context would be, I think, clarity that every manager in the hierarchy has around what the outcome needs to be. And so mm-hmm. they hold their teams accountable. So they define the inputs.
Right.
Okay. We need to increase our sales by some number. Right. And so you are the head of the sales team, or you're the marketing leader who needs to create pipeline or generate leads for the sales team. Right. And so you define the inputs. Okay. We need to, in order to make that sales number mm-hmm. happen, the marketing leader needs to generate this many leads. Right. The sales leader needs to actually add to headcount, you know, to increase carrying capacity. And so everyone has clarity on let's define the inputs and drive towards those and measure against the sales increase.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a component of it. But depending on the level, like some of the genius of it is the accountability is for the objective, not for the inputs into the objective.
Yes, correct. So. But all of the inputs that are created, there's natural accountability baked in to those actually contributing towards the objective, right?
Yeah.
And then on a practical day-to-day level, a manager is holding their individual contributors, let's say, you know, the people on their team, accountable to the inputs.
They believe accomplish.
They believe accomplish the objective, right?
Yeah, for sure.
How about on a very individual day-to-day level as a manager who is holding people accountable to the inputs that you know, that they believe or that have been agreed upon will accomplish the objective?
Yeah. I think a couple of things I've learned on this is one, you have to repeat the objective a lot.
Every day.
Every day. And I think that's even more important than repeating the inputs, because the inputs are important too. But generally, if I'm a marketer or I'm a data analyst, like since that's the career path somebody's chosen, they're like relatively familiar with the inputs. I'm a marketer, like I need to send emails. Like say that's part of your job. And people get that like they feel like they're being productive when they're sending emails, and when they're not, they don't. Yep. Or pick a thing.
Or the inputs need to change because whatever current set of inputs that you had as your initial hypothesis that would achieve the outcome aren't working, right? And so we need to change the inputs.
Well, but most people come pre-baked with inputs.
Yes.
So you hire them, they come pre-baked, and they have like a playbook of like 4 or 5 inputs of what they know how to do, and that's what they know to do. And they can do more or less of each and kind of mix and match, but they just come with a baked thing of inputs.
Most of the time.
But they do not come baked with, most of the time. But they don't come baked with objectives, typically.
Yes.
Because those can change from company to company, which is fair. And then B, because, I don't know, it's kind of not their job to come up with objectives.
Yeah. Two or three additional things that come to mind for me. One is being really consistent and really early on holding people accountable.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, at a basic level, it's actually surprising how common it is for managers to avoid just asking people to do their entire job, right? Fulfill all of your job responsibilities.
You mean like they get happy with like, they do about 3/4 and it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Or half.
Yeah. Or half. That's one thing actually.
Right.
The other that comes to mind is just quality. And I think the reason probably for the first one, just getting people to do their entire job, but then also the quality aspect is it's very time consuming to be proactive on reviewing all of the work product, trying to understand what someone's doing and managing that really well so that people operate in an environment where there's a super high standard,
right,
for how much work you get done and the quality of that work. And I'm not talking about micromanaging. I'm just talking about, understanding the throughput of your team on a detailed enough level that ultimately the ideal outcome is people grow. They get really better, they get really good at their craft. They become a better, they become a better professional as a result of that. And that's pretty rare. I think the last thing that comes to mind is if you aren't proactive about that early, you get more of what you subsidize in that, the worst version of this is you get to your quarterly review or worse, your 6-month review or annual review. And there's a bunch of stuff that comes up that needs to change. Right. And it's like, no, you need to address that essentially in real time as it comes up in my experience. There's tact around that.
But. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think one thing that I would add would be having a team because that, you're absolutely right on the quality thing, but the way to sustain it is to have really high team standards and have everybody want to be accountable to the standard and to have a lot of peer review as a component of that standard. Because then you as the manager, you're not like a complete bottleneck for everything.
Yes, totally.
I think that's the only
thing. A culture that you build on your team.
Right.
For sure.
Right.
But to build that is an immense amount of work.
Yeah.
It's an immense amount of work.
Right.
Okay, switching gears, accountability in the age of AI. And so let me give you a really specific example that I want you to field as a manager. There you are working hard to create a culture of peer-to-peer accountability, top-down accountability for you as a manager, where you're setting the tone for, quality and throughput. And AI enters the picture and the results are not evenly distributed. And this, I think, is a very real challenge. So I'll be very specific here with examples. So let's say that, someone on the team who maybe was, sort of, let's say a mid, good employee, let's talk about agreeable data.
Mm-hmm.
A good employee, like good analyst, but not blowing you away.
Mm-hmm.
And they begin to use AI and it's like, whoa, their work product is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Another situation where, let's say, someone who's really good starts to use AI, and maybe you start to see more mistakes in their work, right? Mm-hmm. So two scenarios. There are infinite, you know, number of scenarios. Address each one of those. How are you going to deal with that? You know, because in the first scenario, it's obviously a net benefit, right? I think.
Right.
How do you think about that? And then how do you think about the second person where there's more mistakes?
Yeah. I think it's actually this. I mean, there's nuances between the two, obviously, but mm-hmm. this answer is the same as I think AI rewards right thinking.
Hmm.
So we'll start with the second example of like further mistakes, you know, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably some workflow tweaks. I talk about this a lot. Talk about a pie chart of like how you spend tokens and tell people, how do you spend tokens? And then the default, I don't even think people verbalize this, but like, well, we spend tokens building, like doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, you can spend tokens researching. You can spend tokens planning. Mm-hmm. You can spend tokens prototyping. You can spend tokens coding. You can spend tokens doing QA. People don't have enough buckets. So I typically, the first person, maybe they're doing great. Maybe there's not a lot there. But on the other one, I'd say you're like, your allocations are off. Mm. Like if there's a quality work product, quality problem, it could be like a QA thing. You need to spend more time here. Or it could be you need to spend more time in research and thinking because there's like fundamental things that get you off track because you didn't start in the right place.
Yep. How do you think about presenting work to a client of yours that you know has been a large amount of the work has been generated by AI, you know, for one of your employees, mm-hmm. right? They're going to, let's say they're building a data app or they're building a report or, you know, or you implement a data analyst agent for one of your clients, right? How does that work? How does the accountability work there, you know? Yeah. Or how do you, let's say you have the person who is doing really, really well with AI, right? And then there's sort of a major problem. They ship something to a client and there's a big problem with it, right? How do you deal with that?
Yeah. So super top of mind is that the data analyst agent, like managed agents, mm-hmm. is what we're working on. And we're working on one right now. And I'm super excited because we started with, what do we want this to be able to do? We started with objectives.
Mm.
So the agent comes with objectives of like what it should be able to accomplish with like a fair amount of granularity.
Mm.
And then we will work backwards and build evals for like what it should be able to accomplish. Mm. And then iterate, like integrate systems, mm-hmm. and connect things. Mm-hmm. And then every time that agent has changed, evals run and they pass or fail, mm-hmm. based on what we said we wanted it to mm-hmm. do. So I'm super excited about that.
And evals, just define evals really quickly, because I think it's a super important mm-hmm. concept.
Yeah. So we've got the most simple version of this. So I've got five to 10 questions I want this agent to be able to accurately answer every time.
So how many daily active users do I have?
Yeah.
You know, what was my margin,
right?
You know, from sales in this product category last week?
Yep. So start with 10 and maybe over time it gets to be a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have it run through the 10.
Mm-hmm.
So you like hold the answer queue over here where it can't see it. It's out of context.
Mm-hmm.
And then you run through the 10 and see how it does and then compare it. And, you know, did it get 10 out of 10, 9 out of 10, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then the idea is, you know, you ship it the first time. 10 out of 10, like good. And anytime you change it to like, quote, make it better, we have to prove that we made it better because it has to achieve
Yep.
Yeah. And then the really tricky part right now is agent memory is becoming a thing. Like people may have noticed this, like ChatGPT has this thing where it can kind of remember previous conversations mm-hmm. across threads. Claude kind of has it. And then a lot of these agents are going to have it as a component.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the trickiest part because the agent is changing in real time. And these evals, even though we didn't make any like core changes, the memory changed some and it may affect the eval. Mm. So I think that's an interesting space right now.
What you're saying is that you actually are implementing accountability in the agent workloads themselves.
Right.
So the agent workloads run and they have accountability built into the system.
Right.
So, which is super cool. But then the agent's also generating work, right? Now we have multiple layers, right? It's not just the analyst who's going in and writing SQL or Python and performing an analysis, right? They are directing an agent who's running loops. There's accountability through evals that benchmark the agent's work.
Right.
But then that still surfaces back up to the analyst and then eventually makes it to the client, right? And so you're introducing risk there, or are you introducing risk?
Generally, clients are directly interacting with the AI.
Okay, they're directly interacting
in this use case, yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, sure. And the risk is is completely naive to think that your evaluations are going to cover all use cases.
Right. There are going to be mistakes that are made.
Yeah. And mistakes that are made, and just there's like a practical, like back to the token budget thing, like how much money do you want to spend on evals? Mm-hmm.
Like, right. Yeah, yeah.
It's just there's some practical things there too, and time and whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think, so that's how I'm thinking about it when it comes to that. And then as far as deterministic things that are produced with AI, that's kind of that other bucket, I think. Back to the allocation thing, I would say. I was like, all right, how much time and effort do we spend on QA allocation? How much on research? How much on planning? How much on actually like implementing? And 9 times out of 10, it is not enough on research, not enough on planning, not enough on QA.
Mm.
It's all three or like one of those things.
Yeah, super interesting. There was a great blog post that we published at Vercel by one of our engineers called Agent Responsibly.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the challenges I think that we have with implementing AI in our day-to-day work is that throughput can increase dramatically.
Yes.
And that means you sort of have, you know, two options, and this is an oversimplification, right? But it's like, okay, you just accept throughput's going to increase dramatically and some of it's going to be non-deterministic, and that's fine, right?
Right.
Or you have to figure out how to deal with a lot more review of output.
Right.
Right. I mean, and that could be code. It could be, you know, an analysis. It could be writing. Right. And so there's, which is a very real challenge. Right. If everyone becomes significantly more productive, you know, there isn't an equal increase in productivity on every type of review.
Right.
And so this blog, Agent Responsibly, I think was really, really interesting because it was actually based on an internal memo, I think, or a talk that this engineer gave in a team stand-up. And it sort of made the rounds internally because it was a very compelling, sort of charge for accountability. And so we ended up publishing it on the blog. But essentially, it drew lines of jurisdiction. And it said, you know, at Vercel, if you're going to push code to production, then it doesn't matter if you wrote it or an agent wrote it, you own it, right?
Right.
And so the production problem is your fault. Like,
right.
And you take full responsibility for that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of drawing the lines of jurisdiction, right? And it's, you know, the nuance there is that not every project is production code, right? Yep. And even when you're changing production code, not every change is as critical, right? And so if I'm doing a database migration, that's really different than changing the font size, you know, for an H3 on the blog, right? Those are dramatically different levels of consequence,
right?
If something goes wrong. And so the level of required accountability is not evenly distributed, and I think maps to the amount of consequence, right?
Right.
But it is a really interesting time for managers who need to review work, especially when there's way more work to review.
Right.
And especially when that work needs to be reviewed by a human. In my role, you know, I review and edit a lot of content. and we don't publish anything that has not gone through a full, that has not been fully scrutinized and like and reviewed by a human,
right?
Right. And so, but we also use AI very heavily. And so the amount of review required is really significant, because before it was like, okay, people can only do this so fast, you know, and so you add more people, you know, but now it's very different because the throughput of a very small team is super high, you know, which is a challenge. But we tend to treat it things the same way on my team, not tend to, but we have human review, right?
Right.
And that is tricky. I think one of the challenges that leaders will increasingly face in the age of AI is defining jurisdiction and accountability along those lines, especially related to consequence. And there are some areas that are very clear on that, right? A database migration, no question.
Right.
But there are a lot of areas where it's kind of tricky to answer that question.
Right.
And so why don't we end with some practical advice? So for a leader who, let's think about a leader who is like well on their way to implementing AI in the workplace. Maybe they're at the place in the adoption curve where, you know, they're still in the learning phase, but throughput is probably going to increase pretty significantly. What would you say to the leader who's going to be dealing with, one, a lot more throughput and review, and then two, where do I draw the lines of, you know, where do the lines of jurisdiction fall, and how do I implement those well?
Right. So I don't think management by objectives works for agents yet, and people are trying to do it. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of like hype recently around, there's this goal command, like give the agent a goal, mm-hmm. or an objective, have it do a thing. Recently, I think loop engineering is a term, which is a similar concept. Before then, people keep pushing up against this, like give the agent an objective, give the agent an objective. And sure, to some extent, I do think you can do that, but not in the same way that you would give a human an objective yet.
Yep.
And because of that, the human objective, I think, is still more important. And the human is still in charge.
Yep.
Like, we don't actually have any AIs managing humans at this point, despite what some people may be saying.
I think we do have some humans asking AI to manage them.
Yeah, totally.
But that's
totally
different.
Yeah. Yeah. So the practical, though, is to remember that. It's like, wait, because if you work with these things for a long amount of time, like, you're totally right that it can be like, what do you think I should do? You know what I mean? You can just get down the road of like,
oh yeah,
what should I do?
Absolutely.
Like, you just tell me, right? Like,
right.
And you can get a answer that sounds right.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a really practical thing that I found there is, cause back to the like time research, time planning, time doing QA,
mm-hmm.
and then of course like sometime building, is taking some of those other steps more analog. So taking, all right, let's do the planning, like whiteboard audio, like not I can use a computer, or let's do QA is the toughest one to take that, because at that point, like, you've usually generated a lot of work product that it needs to stay digital. But planning and research both,
mm-hmm.
I think, and now AI is super helpful for research too. But I think both of those things, like, just as a really practical example, there's a few of us in the room the other day, we were whiteboarding something, and then somebody got out voice AI, I think it was ChatGPT or mm-hmm. one of the other ones, and we're whiteboarding and drawing out like system diagram, and then literally like live chatting with AI, and it's going and doing some web searches and like, hey, I think we need like an email tool, and I'm like, hey, like, what do people use? Like,
right.
something like SendGrid, and then it goes and finds three alternatives. Like,
mm-hmm.
just that kind of thing.
Sure.
Is a really neat
totally
way to work. Another really neat way, which we've talked about a lot, I think you use Whisperflow a lot, and use a similar thing where you start with your ideas, and you can be as unorganized and as whatever as you want, and just talk out the plan, and then easily have an organized outline of your thoughts that's like very coherent from the plan. And then just use those grounding starting points versus what people tend to do is just hop in and like, just start like, hey, I need to build this thing or do this thing. Like, can you do it?
Yep.
And then, and you do get some cool, even if you work that way, you can still get some cool moments like, wow, like, look at all, like, this was so great.
Mm-hmm.
But the consistency over time of like where I've gotten best result has been starting here with some kind of like longer input other than like, hey, can you build the thing?
Mm.
And I think because it occasionally works when you say like, hey, can you build the thing? Mm-hmm. It's really tempting to just work that way because it's easier.
Yep. Yep. So if I had to summarize that, you pointed out a couple things. One would be go analog, which I think my interpretation is that that's to continue to build muscle, right? Like whiteboard,
right.
Maintain your ability to collaborate and think creatively without AI.
The best meetings I'm in are still multiple people, whiteboard, multiple people have markers, and we're like physically collaborating on a actual whiteboard. They're still the best meetings.
Yep. And then also doing the upfront work on the input and not getting lazy on, you know, just issuing a very basic command. Right.
Right.
Which
you can still do, like you can do that. And I'm guilty of that too, but then I just spend a bunch of time editing, you know?
Right.
And I think like
the review.
Yeah. Like I could have done. Yeah. Cause you can technically, and it's important to note this, cause I think you can get to that same quality output and you get to pick which side you want to put more work in.
Yeah.
And I would say 9 times out of 10, it's better to put more work in over here on the planning and research than more work on the QA and editing.
Yes.
So if you find that you spend tons of time on QA and editing, like try putting more effort into planning and research.
Yes, I totally agree. That was the third thing that you brought up is make sure that your pie chart is balanced and heavily weighted towards planning and research.
Right.
Yep. One of the interesting things I think when it comes to accountability in the age of AI is that it's easy to use our pre-existing model for work as the baseline and forget that the way that we work is actually changing pretty dramatically, right? So there are entirely new ways of doing things that we did before. And at least one of the major shifts that I see, and I actually, someone, we'll put it in the show notes, I'll dig up the tweet, is a guy named L.M. Sakasis. How about that for a name?
Love it.
He's written about technology's impact on us as humans and society for a very long time. Unbelievable thinker. And he summarized, I think, the risk in a way that is very concise and really helpful for leaders. He said that one thing that is unique about AI is that it can very easily and almost even naturally erode your ability to use it well, which is a very unique characteristic of a technology.
Right.
And that describes exactly what you were talking about, right? Where my pie chart is way out of balance,
right.
Which is interesting. Side note, if your pie chart's out of balance, it gets way more expensive because you have to do way
true.
More turns,
yeah.
Which is interesting.
Good point. Yeah.
So I would think about that as a leader as well. So using AI well as good thinking is actually cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I, and so in the, you know, with erosion of your ability to use AI as a result of using AI with that as the backdrop.
Right.
One thing that I actually believe that I'm going to start doing, because I've done a lot of this personally and I'm going to talk to my team about it, is intentionally putting in practice, sharpening your skills without AI, because it makes you, it dramatically increases your ability to wield AI, especially for writing. I think that's true generally.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, in my world, we use AI to write a lot. And I just find that the more that I practice writing without AI, the more helpful it seems to get when I use it, which is really interesting, and even changes the way that I use it or like where I choose to employ it. And it's really fascinating. So I guess those are my recommendations for the leaders out there thinking about accountability.
We've got one more. You know, Dan Shipper from Every.
Yes.
He's on Lenny's podcast.
Yep.
Great episode.
Yep.
You guys should check out. But he's kind of an AI thinker and very much a builder, less on the like academic side.
Every has like a bunch of products.
We have several several products.
They're like a product studio.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things he got me thinking about from that podcast was, so he was going through essentially how they use AI and talking about how his thinking has changed. And, it's just so interesting to dig in their world. And he talks about like them really, thinking like moving to the agent, like working with agents versus prompts, right? Like, which I think a lot of people have gotten there at this point, but I think, I guess it was Lenny like asking like, well, you know, what's next? I think the thing I took away from that with my team is like, as we're thinking and planning and researching, like the core thing is walking through, and this is kind of like what you were saying with writing, is walking through the steps without every time like having your hand held. Because that's like the AI is like, if you're used to having your hand held and you like just stay there, then like it's like too uncomfortable. Like when it's not there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
And you get, and then,
yes, yes.
And the way I would, and the other like component of this is not the remember we've talked a lot actually in the past of the blank page problem, which like 5 seconds on that is essentially like people typically start using AI, they pull up a blank screen and then it's like, well, what do I even type?
Right.
But I think for my team, it's almost like full circle of like, don't ever start with a blank page. Start with something like human produced that's like as close as is reasonable to what you wanted, and then start using AI.
Okay, I have a very specific example of this that I think will be great to close out on. So I hired a guy, I'll say his name, I hope he doesn't mind, but his name is Kevin Sundstrom. Okay. He was at GitHub. He built the content agent that they use inside of GitHub.
Sweet.
Sort of built that out, and just a really, really sharp guy. And he's only been on the job for 2 weeks. Okay. And we are in the process of sort of, you know, we had a very, very small team, and so we built out this content agent. Actually, another Kevin on my team, Kevin Corbett. I'm just going to give so these guys Kevins. Credit because they're great. I only hired
Kevin. Do you have
Kevins.
A third Kevin?
No.
I'll look for, I'll help you. I'll
no, the third that. Hire was Amelia, who's amazing as well. But Kevin Corbett built out this really great agent, but it was sort of like we used it, right? And so there's like rough edges and it's super powerful, but there are just a lot of things like the ergonomics weren't great, but it's like awesome, you know?
Right.
And there was sort of another like lighter weight agent that, you know, other people in the company were using that was sort of like a derivative of this or whatever, but this is sort of like our content engineering agent. And so we've just been so busy because we were such a small team that we hadn't had time to really, you know, spend cycles on improving the agent and then rolling it out to the rest of the company. Right. And so now that we have more people on the team, a big focus is let's really augment this. Let's fix the ergonomics and the UX, and then let's start to expose it in surfaces so that other people in the company can use it. And so Kevin Sundstrom, in our first like one-on-one meeting, he wanted to talk a lot about the content agent. And I was like, great, you know, we need, you know, let's make this thing awesome. I mean, it is awesome, but let's make it like, you know, usable and, you know, and get adoption throughout the company. And he said, you know, I think that we're sort of missing like the most important piece of this thing. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, like if we use this on our team, it feels like a really powerful tool. And it is a really powerful tool. He said, but if we, as we start to think about distributing this to the rest of the company, he said, it's probably not going to produce the same results because it doesn't like force or help people do the hardest part. And I said, okay, well, that's really interesting. What do you mean? And he said, well, like, if you boil really good writing down to its essence, it's that you're bringing like a very well thought out argument to the table. Mm-hmm. And so if you do that and you feed it into our agent, then it feels really powerful, right? And he's like, and that's why we love using it, you know? And that's why like we're okay with the rough edges. Right. And he said, but we're not helping other people do that. And he said, but that's actually the thing that's the hardest that most people really struggle with in writing is really bringing clarity to the ideas that they're presenting, you know, as an argument. And he said, if we want this to produce great results for the rest of the company, we need to make it easier for people. We need to use AI to like draw that out of people. Because if they don't put that into the system, we're not going to get good results out, and they won't.
Having a really powerful Q&A tool is like the best.
Yes, exactly. And so that just really, it was really interesting. He said, it's so hard to do that. And so, but he said, but we can't, it won't be successful without that. And so we need to change the way that we're thinking about this in that we need to make that part easier for people. How do we, you know, sort of draw that out? Anyways, I thought that was really great because it was sort of this like, it was a really great form of accountability where it's like, no, I mean, you have to do the hard work up front still, you know, no matter how powerful the agent is.
So my quick example of this was working on, working with one of our interns actually, to summarize some meeting notes where we did some requirements with a client, and I was like, hey, like you give it a shot. Like, here's the transcription. You know, here's some like rough guidance, like give it a shot, like kind of summarize it. And let's start working on, iterations of what we're going to do for them. And they, you know, and they did fine. And you kind of had a basic outline and stuff. I was like, let me show you a secret. So we go like, and this was just what came top of mind. I didn't have this like super planned out and we'll probably find this over time. I was like, all right, let's go find what is most analogous to what we're trying to do. So I was like, all right, this is, we actually want an architectural overview, and we like got to some more specifics and like data architecture overview, and we kind of refined like, okay, this is the document we're trying to make. We're not just making a generic SOW or whatever. Actually, we need this. So super helpful. And then number two is like, all right, let's go find one. So it's like McKinsey data architectural overview, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, look, it's a PDF. It's like, all right, like this is a decent starting point. And just helping somebody, if you can get to like an already good version of a thing, and then like take your context and overlay it into the already good version of thing, which is what humans already do mentally. Like if you went to school, you just have a mental like list of templates that you can overlay into the context. Like it's the same process.
Yep.
But now it's easier because you've got this infinite list of templates. And as long as you have the ability to construct that right starting point, and then, you know, we ran it back through and it was like 100 times better.
Yeah.
Like 100 times better.
Totally.
And the reaction I got was like, wow, like this is like pretty, you know what I mean? Just got this from the, you know, from the guy. And that's just one of those things where, I don't think that's necessarily obvious.
I agree. Yeah. And in fact, going back to LM Sakasis's point, I think the danger is that you're tempted to shortcut that, right?
Yeah.
And so I think if we had to summarize everything that we've said on the show today, it's don't shortcut the process.
Right.
Maintain your ability to do the hard work up front, and that's a real unlock and actually significantly decreases the risk of, you know, generating output that isn't what you want.
Yeah, agreed.
All right. Well, thanks for joining the Token Intelligence Show. AI is changing the way we work. We help you understand the state of the art, cut through the noise, and use wisdom to become a great leader in the age of AI. And we will catch you on the next show.